I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The award-winning Intrepid reporter Bob Mackin joins me now. He is a keen observer of politics in this part of the world and is counted on to break news on a regular basis. It's a good time to have him on to talk about this current provincial election campaign. I've been reading him for years in the Vancouver 24 Hours and in the Taiyi. He is currently a columnist at Business in Vancouver and was a columnist with the Vancouver Courier. He's written four books, the last being Red Mittens and Red Ink, the Vancouver Olympics. He's regularly heard on Team 1040 and CKNW's The Investigators. His website is at 2010goldrush.blogspot.ca. And on Twitter, his handle is at Bob Mackin. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Bob Mackin. Mr. Mackin, good morning.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. So what do you think will happen on Tuesday? Have you got a prediction as to what will... I mean, most observers think that, objective observers, think that the NDP will win on Tuesday. Do you think that holds?
I think it will. It'll be tighter than we believe it to be, because I think there will be a split. The urban-rural split that has often happened in British Columbia will rear its head again. You can already see what the NDP has been doing in its campaign, trying to reach out mostly to voters in the Lower Mainland, Fraser Valley, and Vancouver Island with its messages regarding, well, a positive message, even though they've been getting more critical. I don't call it negative. They've been getting more critical of the Liberal record in the recent weeks, but they've been trying to peddle the positive message, and they've also been trying to really push the whole anti-tanker, anti-pipeline message. These two messages were employed by Vision Vancouver in the 2011 civic election here in Vancouver, and the only difference there was, of course, it was civic, but also Vision Vancouver was trying to keep power, trying to get reelected, and the NDP are trying to get elected after so many years in opposition. But I think what they're doing is dusting off the Vision Vancouver playbook, because they believe that those messages resonate in the key areas, the key urban areas of the province. And you've been seeing the Premier try to push her messages further north and further outside the Lower Mainland and outside of Vancouver Island, especially to communities that rely on resources. That's really where she's hung her hat, her hard hat, so to speak. Ever since she released this jobs plan back in September 2011, even though this jobs plan has had a lot of criticism for the expenditure on advertising, and for the numbers that she's used to try to claim it has actually increased jobs, when in fact the number of private sector jobs, which is what she should be trying to increase, has not increased to the point where she said. So watch for that urban-rural split to happen, and I think that's going to be the key to it all. The NDP wants to get the numbers and the dense ridings, and we also know that the NDP traditionally has efficient numbers. You know, they're over 48% or so whenever they've won, and I think that's what they're going to try to do this time, just spread it out around the province and win where need be, whereas the Liberals, I think, are going to be hard-pressed to keep many seats that have been traditional Liberal strongholds. We'll see what happens there, if any vote bleeds to the Greens or the Conservatives, or if there is an exodus to the NDP. The other thing ultimately to watch for is turnout. As much as we're seeing the first couple of days of advanced polling have some larger numbers, we're also in parts of the province experiencing summer-like weather. People want to get outside and don't mind stopping off at a polling station for a few minutes. Whenever it does get cloudy and rainy, it does seem to affect voting patterns. And getting out to the vote, especially for older people or people that might have mobility issues. That could happen because the weather forecast is showing some clouds to come in later in the weekend and early next week, and perhaps chances of rain. So that could affect it as well. But the most important thing that could affect turnout are traditional Liberal voters deciding to stay home. And I've talked to several of them in recent weeks, people that are high profile but not really willing to go on the record, unfortunately, that have essentially said that they could never see themselves voting NDP, and that won't change this time.
Yeah.
But they've also said that this isn't the Liberal Party that they supported under Gordon Campbell. They don't trust the current leadership, and therefore, because the Conservatives do not appear to be offering as viable an opposition or option as they could have and should have been doing, John Cummins hasn't really inspired that kind of mass support. The people that I've talked to who are Liberal loyalists are saying, well, they're probably going to sit it out, and we've already seen Kashid go public. He told the Georgia Strait that, you know, here's Kashid, former Liberal MLA, not running again, and not a fan of Christy Clark's leadership or Christy Clark's people, saying that there's no candidate in his riding, including the Liberal candidate, that he's willing to vote for, because all the candidates are just parroting the lines of their leaders. And, of course, he's not a fan of the leader of the Liberal Party, so he's saying he's going to park his vote and not vote on voting day. So I think that's quite significant. So that's another thing to watch for, are people just sitting it out. And we've heard this 801 club talking about what might happen after the election is over on Tuesday, about people in the Free Enterprise Coalition looking to the future to regroup and regain their stronghold for 2017 by dumping Christy Clark.
Now, say she wins Point Grey, and those are one of the seats that are in play in this campaign, and she returns to the House with, say, 20 or more MLAs, do you think she would be a good opposition leader?
She would have to change her style. I mean, we've seen the last 2 years, and she's been talked about as a good campaigner, and various Liberal MLAs, mostly ones who have been... quitting, have criticized her for being too much of a campaigner and not enough of a governor. And if you're going to be in opposition, then you're not you're going to be campaigning to try to get support, but then you have to become a governor in waiting. You've got to propose policy that counters what the government is proposing. You've got to try to make yourself be better than the government. And it can't be about photo ops. She's been doing photo ops the last 2 years. She'd have to go back into her own personal history when she was in the Liberal opposition, when Gordon Campbell was the leader, and she was a prominent critic, and she was pretty effective in the House, asking very tough questions of the NDP back in the day when they were in government, and putting some NDP cabinet ministers on the spot. She was quite effective at doing that. She did it back then. If she wants to do it again, if she does lose, if the party does lose, and if she does win her seat, and if the Liberals do stay in the opposition status, which I think they will, she, I think, would be very effective in doing that if she wanted to do that. The question would be, if the party loses, she wins her seat, party stays in opposition, does she want to be in opposition after being in the Premier's office for 2 years? Does she want to spend the next 4 years doing that? After putting her career and reputation on the line, that's a big question.
Well, where's the Green vote in this election? I mean, are they still strong in the island? Do you think they'll win a seat there, maybe?
Well, there's a lot of attention being spent on Andrew Weaver. He's running over there against Ida Chong, and seeing where that might go. I mean, he's their star candidate, and the Greens are really hoping to capitalize on the legacy of the 2011 federal election, where Elizabeth May had the breakthrough, beating Gary Lunn for a seat, a big surprise, and becoming the first Green MP in Canada, elected MP. Of course, Blair Wilson was did cross the floor from the Liberals to the Greens, but Elizabeth May was the first elected Green MP. We'll see where it goes, because that's part of the reason why the NDP did change its strategy and decide to oppose the tankers and the pipelines, because they wanted to keep that Green vote. I mean, there's talk about the NDP coalition as a coalition of the Green and the Brown, because you have the union side there, which really is the more powerful side of the NDP. The Green side is something that they did lose that a number of years ago. When they were in power, they were seen as too much into the union issues and union interests, and not enough into the interests of the planet and our natural environment here in BC. And we saw what happened in the 2009 election, how the Liberals under Gordon Campbell made a clever strategy to gain support from various prominent Green types, if not full endorsements. They at least had faint endorsements by prominent people.
Like Suzuki and Zipporah Berman.
Exactly. Yeah. And there were people in behind the scenes, like Jim Hogan, public relations executive, who had done work for the Liberal Party or the government under the Liberals, and had brought the two sides together. And Gordon Campbell had tried to dress himself up in green, essentially make himself look like a premier who was paying attention to items like climate change. He had Al Gore come to Vancouver. He had Arnold Schwarzenegger come to Vancouver, who was also similarly interested in those issues and photo ops. And he was into the carbon tax. And, you know, we had other programs that he put forward on the environment side. And, of course, during the Olympics and before the Olympics, Campbell was also a proponent of the Four Host First Nations. He didn't make much headway in getting actual treaties signed, but there were a lot of side deals signed with First Nations in BC. So Campbell really took those issues away from the NDP, which had been natural NDP issues, the environment and First Nations. And we haven't seen Clark do that. So that's given James Stirk and the Greens something that they think they can grab onto. Meanwhile, the NDP under Adrian Dix has tried to regain, I guess, quote-unquote, ownership of those issues. You can see in the platform where they do discuss Aboriginal relations and, of course, the issues regarding the tankers and the pipelines. And in fact, Adrian Dix's campaign, his first stop in the campaign was the Museum of Anthropology at UBC. Now, that is in the Premier's riding in Vancouver Point Grey, but it was doing dual purpose because it was also a facility which is well-known worldwide for being a museum of First Nations and Aboriginal culture and research. So, and he did it right in front of the Longhouse, and that photo was put into their platform. So there you have it, how the NDP was just trying to start on day one to try to regain some of those issues and point out the deficiencies in the Liberals. As much as the Liberals have done a lot of side deals, smaller deals under Clark in the last few months, with First Nations, and you know, got some headway on some smaller treaties, it has not really been about reconciliation like it was under Burton Campbell, and her administration has not been about the environment. I mean, we saw what happened with liquefied natural gas, what she did there to decide that essentially the LNG plants would be exempt from legislation. From you know, the Clean Air Act, essentially, that pollution could happen in order to make these lucrative facilities happen, because they are labor and electricity intensive. But of course, that whole LNG spin is one which I'm scratching my head, because as much as BC does have the reserves to frack to get out of the ground, Russia is so much further ahead, and they're building pipelines to add to the pipelines that already exist over in Asia and to feed China. And you got to think that if the Chinese are that hungry for natural gas in 5, 10, 15, 20 years, unless the market changes somehow, that and as long as they still have good relations with the next-door neighbor, Russia, that that will be their first customer, perhaps only customer.
Yeah. Well, what have you made of how the campaign's been covered by you folks in the traditional media, as well as in the social media scene?
It's going similar to what was researched by Pew Research in their State of the Media report, which looked at the 2012 U.S. presidential election and looked at media trends. Campaigns have changed. It's very, very much corporate style for the main parties. Very slick, very planned. They don't want surprises. They don't want embarrassments. And it is very structured. It's predicated on market research and polling and you know, advertising people behind and also the social media people. I mean, the Liberal campaign has a website, the Ask Christie website, which is by a company called Meme Labs, which is a lower profile division or brother or sister company of Hootsuite, the Vancouver Star company, the Twitter client company. They have this division which does work with various advertising agencies for products, and they're working on that. And, of course, you have people involved on the Liberal side who are also involved with Gregor Robertson's campaign. A fellow named Don Millar was a key advisor to Gregor Robertson to get him into power, and he went over and worked with Christy Clark on contracts with the Office of the Premier, and he's also working on that campaign. The campaign that the Liberals have has been built around that 30-minute infomercial that was on Global that preempted Bob's Burgers, the animated sitcom, a couple days before the writ was dropped on that And they showed it on that Sunday night, 30-minute infomercial, which was hosted by Pamela Martin. I found out and did a story for the Tyee that the people in there were all handpicked because they're friends of the party, and friends in big ways. You had, you've probably seen the two senior citizen fellows talking, one on the other side of the fence.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the fellow on the left side of the fence, named David Fraser, and his wife is the former executive assistant to Gordon Campbell and later Philip Owen at Vancouver City Hall, and she received some government contracts. She worked for 2010 Legacies now, Janet Fraser, and she actually also received from the Premier a Diamond Jubilee Medal recently.
Uh-huh.
And the other fella is the husband of Judy Rogers. Judy Rogers, of course, the former Vancouver City manager.
City Hall, yeah.
Who is chairman of BC Housing and chairman of BC Assessment. She was appointed to those positions by Clark. And, in fact, Judy Rogers and Christy Clark live...
They're neighbors, right?
Almost neighbors.
Yeah.
You know, a stone's throw away from each other in between you know, Cambie and Maine and Vancouver in the Vancouver Fairview riding, not too far from Vancouver City Hall. So there you have it there. And the other interesting part was the number of the people in there were also people attached to Christian churches, New Line or perhaps fundamentalist Christian churches. We've seen the Premier go to various prayer meetings, prayer breakfasts, reach out to the faith communities, mostly to the Christian communities. There's even a fellow there with his father. They're both involved in Christian churches. One of them, the younger fellow, the son, is involved in a technology company. And it turns out that his wife is actually also a Liberal candidate.
Huh.
So, to long story short, I did the story 5 days after the infomercial, and I was quite surprised that no one jumped on that story before I did. That was the week of the Boston Marathon bombing,
yeah.
And I did some stories about local impacts because the Sun Run was coming up. But no one jumped on that story. I was starting to do the story on Sunday night. I got way late on the story. But I got back onto it on Thursday and Friday, got it out in the Tyee. And so I'm thinking that the longer feature stories that we saw during previous campaigns aren't quite there anymore. We are seeing some profile stories. Of course, Jonathan Fowley's profiles mm-hmm. of Adrian Dix and Christy Clark were quite in-depth, and the profile of Christy Clark
made
was
news,
a big
yeah.
newsmaker because of the red light mm-hmm. anecdote where she went through a red light essentially on the advice of her 11-year-old son. That became a newsmaker. That wasn't the focus of the story. It was just there as a piece of color.
An aside, yeah.
And there it went. But this the media has often, in this campaign, really just played the role of stenographer, and that's what the Pew Research Report identified, that you know we're not supposed to be just stenographers. We're supposed to be the filters trying to interpret what does this mean. Where is this going? What's happening? What's the story behind the story? And with social media, we're often seeing that reporters are becoming megaphones. This is something that party strategists just love, so that reporters will go to a press conference, go to a media availability for a politician during campaign. There will be this scripted event, such as what the Premier has done in recent weeks, where she's gone to residential houses and sat down with families and had coffee and chatted with them a little bit. Very, very light things that Stephen Harper did on previous campaigns, or for doing hard hat tours of facilities, or sit down and hammer a nail into a board. Well, party strategists just love this when reporters will follow along, take a photo, and tweet it out immediately. And they say, yo, here's Christy Clark. She just announced this, and this is what she's doing now. It's, is that really the best use of social media, and is that really the best use of journalistic talents during a campaign? Because just as in government communications is very large, and we know about the phenomenon of corporate communications and the phenomenon of the permanent campaign, well, when it is actual campaign time, when the party takes over, they have their own people that can also do that. The parties have their own public relations machine. If they wanted to do that themselves, they would, and they do. They pump out videos and photos on their own. you know, let's maybe step back in the media, let the parties do that. Let's do something differently and try to figure out, well, what is it that the readers, viewers, and listeners really need to know? Be a little more critical, critical and skeptical of what's happening on all sides, because these are important times where these parties are essentially auditioning for a job, a very important job, and unfortunately with our system here, it's really the only time when the citizens are listened to, and because the rest of the time, there's so much power concentrated in the office of the Premier, and that's really where things are, the office of the Premier and the Cabinet, and those are the people that have the power, and they can choose how little or how much to listen to the public. And they do their polling on a daily basis to find out if their messages are being successful or not, but there's often this disconnect, and we're not going to get this chance again until 2017, and we're running out of time.
Yeah.
And other matters, I did some features this week for CKNW. You can find it on the CKNW website, cknw.com, under the investigators.
Mm-hmm.
I did one on some serious issues at the Maples Adolescent Treatment Center and used that as a case study for whether the Liberals during their 12 years have done enough for the most vulnerable children and teenagers in the province, kids essentially that have suffered sexual abuse, physical abuse, kids that are suffering addiction problems, developmental disabilities, mental health issues. Is there enough for them, and are those people that care for them supported enough? I found workers who are at the Maples are suffering from incidents of violence, and there's a climate of fear there, and they say they're understaffed and overworked, and because of that, the clients aren't getting the best care, and some of these children are turning into adults, and they're ending up on the streets or in jails, and this is a serious matter, especially when Mary Ellen Turple-LaFond, who's essentially the child advocate, the independent child advocate, reported recently that if you've got a child who's got a mental illness, you could be facing a year-long wait before you can see a professional, and that's just not good enough. She said the system is broken. And another story I did was on problems with privatization and procurement in the province, how the Liberals in 2001 did promise to clean up government after the NDP scandals in the 1990s. The NDP was, there were no angels in the 1990s. There were the gambling scandals, there was the Fast Ferries cost overruns, there was Hydrogate, you know, some things that they cannot be proud of. And the Liberals came to power in 2001 under Gordon Campbell, promising that they would do better, promising, first of all, that they would not sell BC Rail. 2 years later, they did that. And as much as they did change some things, they didn't change most of the things, and we're seeing some problems over the years. I mean, the BC Rail sale is top of the heap, the one that still has not been resolved, and the NDP, to their credit, are promising a $10 million two-year public judicial inquiry. But other areas have been quite distressing. We've seen incidents at you know, the ICBC chop shop, for instance, a scandal where ICBC workers were taking and buying cars that were totaled, fixing them up, fudging their accident histories, and then selling them, pocketing the money. There were a number of firings that happened there. We saw what happened with the Wood Innovation and Design Center, that a couple of the bidders point the finger at Pat Bell, the minister who's not running again, claiming that he told them that they would be shortlisted. We also saw the Liquor Distribution Branch privatization bid, that the government was so intent on selling that to raise money to help balance the budget in 2012 that they wanted to sell liquor distribution branches, warehousing, and distribution arms after deciding not to sell the retail. And that was a charade that went through the summer that took up a lot of time of the bureaucrats who handle procurement for the government. And a lot of meetings happened. Four companies were shortlisted. These companies spent a lot of time and money developing their bids. And 2 business days before the final bids were due, the government scuttled it. They announced that when the BCGEU got a new contract, that the new contract would include a two-year period, because it was a two-year contract, where the government would still continue to operate the liquor distribution branch as is. So those four companies were told, thanks, but no thanks. They never got a chance to table their final bids. therefore, we never got to know really whether there could have been any savings whatsoever. I wonder if it might have something else to do with who these, some of these companies were. I found two of them had a close relationship indirectly. Excel Logistics was the one driving this privatization. They're owned by a company out of Germany called Deutsche Post DHL. Deutsche Post DHL has a subsidiary out of Italy called GORI, G-O-R-I, and GORI has a very close relationship with a company in Richmond called Container World. Container World was another of the bidders, and they've got the largest liquor warehouse in the province, private liquor warehouse in the province. They have a contract already with the LDB for pre-distribution, and in a memo that I received from a source, Excel actually talked about using this corporate relationship to take over Container World so that it could get the business. And so you had two of the bidders who had a relationship that I thought, on the face of it, would look too close for comfort. Mm-hmm. And we still have had no real explanation from the government, from Deputy Premier and Liquor Minister Rich Coleman, about why this deal, which was supposed to have been something which was supposed to be good for the people of BC, even though there was a business case, why it was scuttled.
Does it frustrate you, Bob, when you do the work that you do? I mean, you're doing the work of a journalist, essentially, as we know it, as we once knew it, that people will ascribe some sort of political bent to your motive, say?
Well, that's humorous whenever I hear people do that, because it's the same thing I've heard before. Parties who are in power, or parties who are in power who are scared of losing their power, or can see their power slipping away, start to, instead of blame some of their own mistakes, are looking for scapegoats, and of course they can blame the opposition parties, and they also often blame the media. I'm not running for any political office, and I'm not trying to get their job, and I'm only trying to deliver what the people need to know. I want to ask questions on behalf of the people, and I want to pass the information on to the people. I heard the same criticism back when the Silk Reds were falling apart back in the early 1990s. I got out of journalism school in 1990. A year later was the election, and you know, I was doing some internships working at the North Shore News in North Vancouver, and going to all candidates' meetings, and boy, I heard the same thing. Yeah. Heard the same thing from Silk Red supporters. Oh, you're just an NDP, or you're against us. And in 1996, you know, when Glenn Clark was in power and the NDP was in power and eventually won again, you know, following the NDP campaign, asking tough questions about NDP candidates and Mr. Clark himself, I heard the same thing from NDPers saying, oh, you're just against us, oh, you're just a liberal. And the same thing in 2001 when the NDP was on its way out and deserved to be on its way out. Under Ujjal Dosanjh, and liberals had some great ideas to clean up government and made a lot of promises. I heard the same thing from NDPers then, oh, you're just a liberal. And now the liberals are looking like they're on their way out after 12 years, a tired party with a lot to answer for, but not giving many answers to. And their supporters are saying, oh, you're just an NDPer, you're just against us. I've heard this all before, and it's not productive, and the political parties really should look at how they conduct themselves and how the system works, because I mean, it's interesting, we're having an election at the same time as the Canucks are out of the playoffs, swept out of the playoffs by the San Jose Sharks, and, well, the criticism of the Canucks is similar to the criticism of the Liberals in that here is a party and here is a hockey team that put all its eggs in the basket to be the party of now or the party of the past, and didn't do enough to look at the future on how it can regenerate itself to bring new people in, to bring new leaders in, to bring new ideas in, and to share some of the power and also to listen more to the grassroots. I think that you know, the Canucks have lost their way, and I think the Liberals in many ways have lost their way, and you know, they ought to be listening more to their own members, because I'm getting phone calls, emails, and meeting some of their own people who are happy that the media... some of us in the media are asking the tough questions because the party is letting down its own membership.
Yeah. Bob, it's been a pleasure having you on. I've been watching and reading your stuff for years in admiration. Thanks for this.
Thank you.
The website for more, 2010goldrush.blogspot.ca. Bob Mackin on the line from North Vancouver. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta. Bob, are you still there?